This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast. I'm your host this week, Anne Nicholson Weber, and my guests are Kate LaPuma and Michael Halberstam, respectively the executive director and artistic director of Writers Theater. And we're here to talk about Writers Theater, just try to get kind of a profile of this quite amazing institution up in Glencoe, which is just starting its 20th season. Michael, you were there from the beginning, so maybe you could just start by telling us what was the original idea for this company.
The idea of Writers Theater was born out of a passion for text and a passion for actors, which have really driven through every aspect of really my career, both as an actor and as a director and as a producer. When I was an actor back in the way, way, way olden days now, I just noticed how actors were often disenfranchised from the experience of putting on the show. And the actors went out to the bar afterwards. They would get together and talk about how the show could be fixed. And usually they were right. Mm. And it occurred to me that if I was starting a theater, maybe finding a way to tap into that energy and actually give the actors a place where they could have a voice might help give a consistency of production. So that was one very, very passionate idea. The other passionate notion was the fact that actors are often the lowest rung on the totem pole when it comes to compensation. Mm-hmm. And so we made a great effort from the very first days of the theater to pay actors a living wage. It's hard for them, I think I said in a recent piece, it's hard for them to hold up the mirror to nature if they're too hungry to actually carry the weight. And the other thing, back in the late 80s, early 90s, the director had become such the centerpiece of the production, and directors were, I think, coming out of training programs where they were encouraged to put enormous behemoth concepts on top of plays. And it seemed to me that actually allowing the play to come through was a good way of nurturing both artist and, intent of playwright. And so creating an environment where conceptual production wasn't on the table seemed to me a great way to be able to nurture an actor.
So who were the sort of original folks?
Co-founder Marilyn Campbell. Mm-hmm. I met Marilyn through mutual friends. We took a class together and we just hit it off right away. But Marilyn had a script that I was particularly enamored of, that she and Linda Laundra had adapted from the writings of Anne Sexton, called My Own Stranger, which, Anne Sexton, confessional poet, mm-hmm. 60s and 70s, an astonishing woman. She was, afflicted by bipolar disorder, probably. And yet back in the day before they understood these things, she was ostracized. They had no medication, and yet she still managed to survive under remarkable circumstances. And she poured all of her torment into her poetry. Mm-hmm. And it was a remarkable, adaptation in terms of bringing an insight, not only into the nature of what it means to be manic, to be bipolar, but also into the creative act of writing poetry. And that script really became a foundation on which we started to develop the entire theater company, because we wanted to find a home for this script. It seemed to me to embody the essence of good writing and good acting. Three actors, fantastic poetry. Mm-hmm. It actually took us a little while to get that piece up on the ground. We started a little slower than that with Marilyn and I adapted three short stories by Chekhov, and we took an Elliot Hayes adaptation of Gogol's Diary of a Madman for our first production. I'm getting ahead of myself. There's so much to try and talk about in the early years.
But
it's almost impossible to encapsulate it into a couple of sentences.
I think that's really interesting, though, those first three works say so much about what was your direction, certainly in the initial years. So that's actually illuminating. Well, okay, so.
And still actually hold true to the day in terms of the kind of work that we do now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not to say we've grown and we've developed and we've shaped, but we still have the core principles. What I should say is that we had a couple of friends who connected us with Pat Raymond, who is one of the three owners of a bookstore here in Glencoe, independent bookstore over on Vernon Avenue, Linda Wine and Diane Schwartz. And Linda and Diane and Pat had this vision to create a bookstore that would become a cultural center for the village. And they had a back room that was fairly spacious, they were using for storage for the most part, but they conceived the idea, especially because Pat was a playwright and a writer of note herself, published author, that it would be a wonderful place to have a writer's group and perhaps also get some play readings going. And once we were hooked up with Pat and Linda and Diana, we came in and saw the potential of this space to actually create a theater in the environment, a theater in which by the very nature of its ascetic aesthetic demanded that you focus entirely on the acting and the text, because you couldn't really build a lot in the way of sets. You didn't have a lot of room to be able to put lights and costumes in there. There were no offstage space. There was just a little area that we created as a dressing room in the bookstore,
where you can hear the actors chatting as you go in and out of the theater.
Indeed,
was part of the fun. Well, that answers one of my questions, which was, why are you here in Glencoe? That seems like quite a radical idea, particularly maybe for the time, maybe still, that, you know, young companies put themselves in grotty storefronts in, you know, low rent districts of cities. So to come up to a North Shore suburb seems like a very surprising thing to do. Did you talk about that? Did you say, you know, does this make sense? Or was it just, here's a space, we know what we want to do, and we'll just try it here?
It's a sense of a space. We had the right people, the right time, the right energy, the right space. And the first two shows that we put on, really with minimal amounts of advertising, just putting a few posters up in local windows, we sold them out. Mm-hmm. So there was clearly an audience here.
Right.
I'm not sure if any of us thought that we would actually stay in Glencoe and Glencoe would become the home for us and so much part of our identity as it's become now.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a happy accident in a way. You also have a highly, highly educated theater-going audience up here. We didn't have to explain what a fourth wall was. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to explain who our playwrights were. Mm-hmm. The audience was already informed. They knew what Chekhov was. They wanted to come see Chekhov. And that made for an exciting engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let me go back to one thing you said, because this has always been so interesting to me. From the beginning, you were committed to paying actors well.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that when you're just, you know, three people or whatever, you know, just this upstart young company? How do you find the money to pay them?
Well, for 7 years, I did everything.
Mm-hmm.
I farmed out what I couldn't do. I knew I wouldn't be able to handle payroll or do the taxes. Kala Talent was a payroll service that provided our payroll and our workman's comp, et cetera, for many years.
But that, was that from the beginning? I mean,
they came in fairly quickly, but you need to pay, if you're paying, equity actors, there's a lot of paperwork to fill out.
Mm-hmm.
And we went equity within the first year of production.
That's an extraordinary thing. It really is. And to make the commitment to do it and then pull it off. I mean, you'd think that you were crippling yourself.
I would add, I think that's what's extraordinary about this organization that Michael started, is that's the mission and that's the philosophy. And so if you, for example, in the budgeting process, when you talk about paying your actors, that's something you do first.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fill out the rest of your budget, which usually is opposite
the other way, right?
A lot of other companies, or, you know, it's just a different way of thinking.
Well, and that clearly was part of, I mean, my impression is that the company got on the map pretty quickly because you had these, you know, well-known, well-established, wonderful actors coming up to the back of a bookstore in Glencoe and doing great work.
That's right. And it's not just about compensation. Compensation is your base starting point.
Mm-hmm.
I think you've made a commitment to tell the actors at that point that you value them most of all in the process.
Mm-hmm.
But then the next step has to be how you treat them within the rehearsal process, so that they have empowerment over the work, empowerment over the stage, because ultimately everybody gets to walk away after opening, except the actors who are there night after night after night engaging with the audience. And if you don't give the actors the voice to carry forward with authority that ownership, then you don't generally have a consistent production. So everything became about focusing towards nurturing them, and if they needed, I remember one of our actresses needed a specific kind of curler for her hair beforehand, and so it was, we're talking about $70-$80 to go out and buy this little set of curlers for her, and it made her feel comfortable, mm-hmm. able to do the show.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the $70 that I spend on that compared to having her distracted every night when she's in her preparatory stage before mm-hmm. she goes on to commit an act of enormous bravery, which is to share her deepest emotional vulnerabilities with a group of complete strangers.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk then, and then we're going to get to the present very quickly, but I think this philosophy is hugely important in understanding the culture of the institution. What in specific could you say was distinctive about your process that enfranchised the actors, as you've said? What was different about the way plays were being put on here that gave them, you know, a voice in the rehearsal instead of only at the bar afterwards, second guessing?
Well, you know, I wouldn't want to say that we don't do anything that everybody else does or tries to do, but, and perhaps the compensation is the glue that binds it all together, mm-hmm. because I think it's very easy for theater companies to get to the point where we think that, you know, well, we're the only one doing this. I know every theater company strives to empower their actors in the process.
Well, that's probably not true, actually. There are directors who don't. That's not even part of their philosophy.
That's true. But I think that would be the part. I would say there are probably very few artistic directors that it is not part of their philosophy in the institution that they're trying to set up.
Yeah.
What I would say is I've been very lucky with the directors that I've worked with over time and the actors with whom I've collaborated. So what I tried to do, I can only talk about what I did personally, which mm-hmm. is I tried to take the best of what I knew through all the processes that I'd been through in my life. And pull those off and bind them together into this one experience. When you articulate it on a greater level, you're mm-hmm. talking about trying to remove distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy for artists to become distracted in the rehearsal process if they don't feel like they have the voice to be able to say when things aren't in place for them in the rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it just means buying better coffee.
Yeah.
You know, or popping open a bottle of champagne after a particularly rough week and buying some shrimp and putting that out for the cast or bringing over a chocolate cake.
Mm.
So it's never diminishing, I think, the obsessive compulsions, the focus, the distractions that can get in the way, never minimizing an actor's need to find a safe space so that the actor can then create work. Because I was an actor, it started as an actor's process,
mm-hmm.
and it's now really migrated its way out into the entirety of the organization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the first 7 years, I was the marketing director. I was the box office manager. I was the janitor. I would I'd go to the answering machine and pull the reservations off the phone. Then I'd run back into rehearsal to direct the play. I was paying my actors, I think, twice what I was earning myself.
Mm-hmm.
Marilyn and I had back at the apartment. We lived together platonically, and she was helping me raise the theater company, I was also helping her raise her two kids. I'm gay, so it was so nice to have this family that I would never have. I would get a phone call at 11:30 at night, looking for reservations, and because it was my home, I'd answer the phone and I'd chat with a patron for 45 minutes. Is this the artistic director? Yes, it is, as a matter of fact.
Uh-huh.
We loved your last play. Oh, really? What did you like about it specifically?
Yeah.
We were able to commit a very intimate engagement with every member of our team.
Yeah. I remember too, and this is still true, but I remember being struck early on coming to the bookstore, coming out, and you would always be kind of at the door shaking people's hands as they left, like a reception line almost.
For the first 12 years, I was there every night, both before the show and after the show.
Yeah.
I think we do a very good job of taking away the idea of them and us.
Mm-hmm.
There's never a time where I don't feel welcome backstage, and I'm the executive director, so sometimes I'm not the first person you would see walking backstage.
By them and us, you mean like the actors and the management?
Well, mm-hmm. I mean everything. I mean staff, I mean patrons, I mean board and the actors. I think there, and I think you just talked about it a little bit in terms of there's a collaboration and a trust that happens. And, you know, I don't think an actor has ever felt that they couldn't come over here to the office to talk about something. And I don't think there's ever been a staff member who felt like they couldn't go into the rehearsal room and watch the process.
Mm-hmm. And the patrons feel that way when they walk out. I mean, we still actually have somebody. We make sure that somebody from the staff, our fantastic house managers, are always at the door as mm-hmm. they're leaving, engaging with the audience mm-hmm. on their way out mm-hmm. to say, did you enjoy the show?
There's a face for the theater. Well, summing up so far, I think being an actor is really a dreadful life overall. And it's great too, but it's hard. It's hard. And in general, actors, I think, artists in general feel underappreciated.
No question.
And it seems like part of this formula that's not the right word, part of this strategy that has worked so well for you is to actually allow artists and then this bigger and bigger group of people attached to your institution to feel appreciated, to feel served, to, you know, like a good hotel, you know, to feel cared about. And that seems really important. Well, okay. So let's bring Kate into this a little more. Kate, you came into this position about 4.5 years
ago,
is that right?
Yeah.
So you're coming up on your fifth
season.
Yeah. What makes, I have the impression that this is a very happy partnership, and I'm interested to know what makes a great partnership between an artistic and an executive director. Kate, can you talk about your perception of that?
Sure. I mean, for me in particular, one of the reasons why I came here when I was leaving New York, and I sat down with Michael, I knew immediately I wanted to work with him. You know, so it starts off from respect. I mean, just for not only the director that he is, but he's an amazing producer. It's very hard to find artistic directors who are both amazing producers in that role, but also pretty incredible directors. And so I think, you know, Michael does both really, really well. I trust him and he trusts me.
Although that has to have been earned. You wouldn't have had that from day one.
Yeah,
no,
well,
I thought we did have it from day one.
It was pretty close. And and I think it comes out of and some of the best solutions to some of the hardest problems come out of Michael, when Michael and I have our biggest arguments.
Shut
and
up.
Whatever, Michael. But the arguments are never, they're not personal. They're about making the best decision for this organization that we both love. And so when we do that, we're in our best place, and usually we come to the same place at the end. So I think we do that really well.
Could you give an example of something that you might have struggled over and how the result was?
Funny thing is, I can never remember fights when we'd sit down to look. I mean, there was one year where we had a very comfortable surplus because of the success of the box office that season. And Kate came and said, I want to give the staff a bonus. And I said, well, what about the actors? And it hadn't occurred to her at that point from the company that from previous experience that you would bring the actors into the loop. But after a little bit of wrestling backwards and forwards, I would say, but nothing, there was no real strenuous objection, just sort of a rethinking and a readjustment.
Never thought of that.
Exactly. How are we going to do this?
How are we going to do that? I think the thing that Kate does so extraordinarily well, and what makes me very lucky to have her in partnership, is she is able to articulate a very esoteric mission in very concrete terms. The budget will reflect the art. The budget will reflect the mission of the theater company. And then ultimately you need a partner who's also going to produce and stretch the limits of the vision of the company beyond where they think they end and into new ideas. It's not just about budgets and business,
It's
about visioning the future of the organization. Kate is also blessed with impeccable taste. And I think that has an awful lot to do with everything.
Yeah. That's a concept that I think is so important, so impossible to talk about, but it really is what draws an audience. It's what allows artists to work together. It's, you know.
Most decisions come down to a matter of good taste. In that situation, I think when you sat down and thought about, well, actually, yes, if we're going to start handing a little money that we've made for the organization back to the people that made it.
Who are those people?
Wouldn't that make sense? But then Kate came back to me and said, well, it's not just the actors, right? It's the designers. And what about the people who helped build the set? And so we had to craft a map of who everybody we thought was identified enough with the project on an artisanal basis that we felt that they deserve some kind of bonus at the end of that year.
That's a great example. Well, Kate, coming into this, what did you bring to the organization?
Well, I was very lucky in that I walked into an organization that had a very strong mission and a strong leader, that it was in a place where it wanted to take the next step. I think Michael, in particular, wanted to see that happen. And so it wasn't a struggle for me to come in and say, you know, I think we could do this. I think we could move forward with this. And he kind of gave me a green light to start thinking more strategically about the future of the organization. And I think that's one thing that I've been trying to do, and I'm sure you've read recently that we're starting to think about a new theater building.
Right.
We're moving forward. We're not thinking of doing it.
Is that something you're not telling me, or maybe there's something I haven't been telling you?
I'm signing checks today for a lot of things. So, you know, that stuff has been extremely exciting for both Michael and I to work on.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? It's taking the mission of the theater company and expanding the boundaries, and the expanding the boundaries means taking a show to New York, which we did in 2007 when we took Crime and Punishment to 59 East 59th Street. It also means building a new structure to house the theater, mm-hmm. because it's currently the current structure is inadequate to the mission of the state of the theater company.
And let me just do a quick fill in there. So we have the space in the back of the bookstore,
which 50 seats,
right? And then you created a second space in the women's club
in 2003,
two blocks away. And now you're saying that instead of that space, instead of the women's club space, is this new space. Will you keep the books on Vernon?
You know, it would be crazy if we have the availability for it, if it's still an option for us to lose any space that we have. Mm-hmm. We, you know, theater companies need real estate in order to create. Everything is on the table right now.
Yeah.
Let's just put it that way.
But the
idea is to, on the table that we're working with right now, is that we pull down the Women's Library Club and erect a new structure that's going to be designed by world-renowned architect Jeannie Gang, who some of your listeners may be familiar with because of her gorgeous Aqua building downtown.
Yeah. Is it bigger? Is it that you need something bigger? What is it? What are the limitations that you need to get beyond that are imposed on you by the women's club space?
Well, you know, as you were talking about Studio Gang, I was thinking about, you know, everything that we've said about nurturing the artists, and it's sort of hard to when we can't necessarily give them a shower backstage. So there are just some, just in terms of amenities for the artists and the patrons who are coming through, we're at a place where it's just not acceptable anymore. So
the actors are all crammed back into a tiny little dressing room. Mm-hmm. So you can't actually fit, there's no storage. You can't fit costumes. You can't fit actor. The actors are exposed when anybody comes backstage. Mm-hmm. The women are at least sheltered behind a screen, but the men are not. So it's very demeaning, I think, for them to be so vulnerable in that way. Mm-hmm. The audience's amenities are almost non-existent. The toilets don't work. The lobby is small and cramped. Mm-hmm. The building is suffering from some infrastructural challenges in terms of leakage that are starting to encroach on our ability to actually function in the space.
And even just in terms of visibility, I can't tell you how many people who are coming to the theater get off that train and wind up wandering the streets of Glencoe trying to figure out where the theater is.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just really no opportunity for us to talk about who we are from the outside. So there needs to be a change. And, you know, the work, what's been amazing over the last, 20 years, but in particular the last 5 years, is the reputation of this organization that has just gone national and international. You know, in between taking some of Michael's work, we just had a show that Michael directed that was conceived and premiered here, A Minister's Wife, that opened at Lincoln Center in New York. Michael also directed Crime and Punishment in New York a few years ago. You know, the New York Times is coming out and reviewing our shows. The Wall Street Journal recently called us one of the top regional theaters in the country. And all that is happening in a building that you don't even know
slightly
theater
goofy
is in.
Building, yeah.
Yeah. It's time. Mm-hmm. It's time that the sophistication and the artistry of what's happening on stage should be matched by a building that could house all that work.
It's also, there are fiscal considerations too. 108 seats. It's very hard for us to grow right now with only 108 seats of income per night. Mm-hmm. And we play to such capacity that, it's difficult for us to grow our single ticket revenue, and we don't want to lose the intimacy, because that's what's that's partly what makes our identity so unique. Mm. But I think we can both retain our intimacy and make a more fiscally responsible and sustainable model for the organization.
Well, let me ask you, because I think that's a really interesting question, the question of growth. Do you know, you've got this culture that is so focused on the intimacy. You've grown to a certain point. I'm sure you must perceive that there are risks of trying to continue to grow kind of forever. So how do you talk about that? And
we talk about it actually quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, this company first and foremost, and this is in relation to the building, and I said this the other night, we're not trying to build a building for Writers' Theater. We're trying to build a new home for Writers' Theater, and I think there's a difference. And at some point, this is not about trying to build a theater and put as many people in as possible. Mm-hmm. It's creating a space that maintains and maybe even enhances what is so incredibly unique and special about this organization. And
well,
I think
sure
a lot
enhances.
Of that is
mm-hmm.
the intimacy. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you can talk about size of theaters and say some 500-seat theaters are intimate, some 1,000-seat theaters are intimate. At some point, it just doesn't become us
right.
anymore. So we want to grow to a point, but we're never going to grow to be a 1,000-seat auditorium. It's just not the culture of this organization, mm-hmm. And it's just not the way that I think we produce at our very best.
Yeah,
I'm comfortable with the idea of Writers Theatre getting to a point where we release our subscription brochure and we have to cap our subscriptions because we have such demand for it, and our single tickets go very quickly. As long as we have a fiscally sustainable model to the point where we can keep gently nudging actor salaries up, where we can look after our artists, where we can attract artists to come and want to create work with mm-hmm. us and collaboration with us from around the country, maybe around the world. And with our pro forma, we have an organization that can do that, can both sustain growth, offers room for growth within both fiscally and artistically, and yet doesn't overreach the limits that actually make us unique.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
part of our limitations, are part of what makes us a special environment. Looking at how Writers Theatre solves putting on a streetcar right. named Desire is part
That's
of the fun
true.
Of coming to the theatre.
That's true. Yeah, in fact, David Cromer did a really wonderful interview. Chris Jones interviewed him at Columbia College. And
yeah, I was there for that.
It was
wonderful.
And Chris asked him, I think, well, what's wrong with being able to have everything you want? And there was this long pause, and then he said, Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And I just thought that is such a profound
That's
wisdom,
right.
though. And it is, I think, interestingly for artists and really all creative people, limitations are helpful to a degree. And mm-hmm. knowing, you know, it's pushing against limitations is what you have to do, but also mm-hmm. accepting that it's not maybe good to have no limitations.
Yes, indeed.
This is very abstract.
It
has
is
nothing
abstract
to do
because
with whether
you
should grow and how much.
And you have to be careful about how you define a limitation and what a limitation, you know, what is a limitation and what is actually an opportunity for invention.
Right.
Through
right.
necessity.
Right. Which is what a lot of what you've done.
Very, very delicate balance right,
right yeah.
now that
right.
we're playing.
Right.
I'd love to be able to give David a better environment in which to come in mm-hmm. and direct. At mm-hmm. the same time, I want to give him some of the same puzzles.
Right.
So that when he comes back with another production for us,
he does something amazing.
He
again.
Does something amazing with
right.
it because he's had to.
Yeah, yeah. I would like to go quickly back to the architecture because I think the challenge of designing space for the theater is a very interesting one and somewhat specialized. But this architect hasn't done a theater before. Is that right?
No, it's not true. She did the Starlight Theater in Rockford.
Uh-huh.
And she's done a couple of significantly high-scale performance venues in Taipei.
Interesting.
Yeah. And she's working on another indoor theater loosely inspired by the Guthrie Theater, also in Rockford.
Okay. So
I think there's a learning curve in terms of the level of working with the specific needs of this theater, but I mm-hmm. think that would be true for anybody.
Yeah.
In some ways, some of the theater architects that we looked at, the people who had done more consistently performance venues and performing arts centers, I think we would have had an equal learning curve because we would have been fighting.
This is how we do it.
Assumptions mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. that we don't hold, truths mm-hmm. that we don't hold to be self-evident.
Right, right.
I think
that's well
what's
put.
Most
yeah.
exciting about Studio Gang in that, you know, it's what I talked about earlier. They're gonna build a home for this theater.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to get a building and we're going to stick a theater in it. And I think that's what they're going to do. I mean, if you talk to any of their clients, I think that's the one thing that they've all said is that they really listen, they communicate, they collaborate.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really important partnership for them and it's an important partnership for us. And mm-hmm. I think because of that, we have this amazing opportunity to create something new and inspirational and something very different on this very particular site.
Mm. Well, it's a pretty cool thing to be doing as you
yeah.
face your 20th season. It
yeah.
seems
Indeed.
Very right. Well, thank you both so much for joining me. It's Writers Theatre has always been one of my very favorite companies for exactly the reason that you said, that you never see anything that isn't really good and often something that's extraordinary.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
That's really lovely to say. Thank you very much.